You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. Also, if you are listening to the podcast, this is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is Lecture 7 of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Understanding Healing, Meditative Reflections on Deepening Medicine Through Spiritual Science, Collected Works, Volume 316. Lecture 7 was given in Dorna on the 8th of January, 1924. My dear friends, will we use the first part of today's session to answer those questions which were not included in the general question, which I have already discussed and which will still be discussed further? And we will then continue today with the discussion from yesterday, in order then to lead to an esoteric conclusion tomorrow. Most of the questions actually fit into what I want to say to you in general. There are only a few questions that require a specific answer, and we will deal with them in no particular order. Question: are there specific exercises to strengthen the so-called forces of magnetic healing in us, and what are those exercises? Well, that of course requires that we say a few words about magnetic healing forces as such. Magnetic healing forces are forces which essentially act between the etheric body of one person and the etheric body of another person. You then have to imagine that the effect of so-called magnetic healing is based on the following. Let us assume someone has a strong personality, that is, he can strongly develop his will and can be given instructions based on particular circumstances. Let us say, for example, that I tell him if he suffers from a particular illness, he should think of the sun at 11 o'clock each morning and imagine that the sun first warms his head, that then the warmth of the head is transferred to the upper arms, the lower arms and hands, so that he reinforces his real strength in this way. Then, once he has reinforced his real strength, he should try to picture very clearly what he experiences of his illness in order to get rid of it through his strength of will. This procedure, as I have described it, can, I say can because it does not happen necessarily, there is always a slight problem with these things, indeed help with the illness if there is no particular organ damage. Organ damage can, of course, extend to all four members of the elementary body, the solid, fluid, gaseous, and warmth one. Then the following has happened. The person concerned has been stimulated in his astral body through the instruction I have given him. My instruction, which he carried out, imagining the sun, the warmth in his head, and so on, this instruction, which he carried out and which strengthened his will, had an effect on the astral body. The astral body worked on his etheric body, and the etheric body in turn had a healing effect on his physical body to balance, to paralyze damage it has suffered, which was not of a deeper organic nature. We cannot say that such cures only occur in what today's medicine calls functional disorders, as opposed to organic disorders, in which there is an actual disorder of the organs. Such differentiation is very imprecise. We cannot say where functional disorders stop and the organic ones start. Functional disorders are always also minor organic disorders, which only cannot be shown with today's crude physiological and pathological resources. As you can see, in such a case, we do not use the forces of magnetic healing, but appeal to the patient to heal himself. That really is the better option under all circumstances, when it is available. As a result, the will of the patient is strengthened and enhanced as we cure him. We can also do the following. We can influence our own etheric body with our astral body, without the other person exerting his will, in such a way that our etheric body acts on the etheric body of the patient in the same way as the astral body acted previously. That is what magnetic healing consists of. The practitioner of magnetic healing does that unconsciously. He influences his own etheric body from his astral body. He can guide the forces he develops by that means instinctively to where they strengthen the forces of the patient by transferring his forces to the patient. We must be clear when we are talking about healing that the practitioner must use whatever can lead to a cure. If we are dealing with a patient who is simply weak, of whom much cannot be asked with regard to his will, we can also, on occasion, use the forces of magnetic healing. But I want to make it expressly clear that magnetic healing forces are, in fact, something quite problematical, which cannot be used in the same way from one case to the next. For this instinctive ability which I have described, where we activate our own astral body in order to influence the etheric body by that means, this instinctive ability is an individual one. There are people who have it strongly, and there are people in whom it is only weak, and then there are those who do not have it at all. So there are indeed practitioners of magnetic healing who are capable of it through their aptitude. But the key thing is that, as a rule, this ability exists only for a limited time. Practitioners with this ability have such magnetism, as it is called. When they start to use it, it is very effective. But after a while, it begins to weaken, and that is when quackery begins in such practitioners, because their ability has receded, but they still act as if they continued to have it. That is the worrying thing every time magnetic healing becomes an occupation. Basically, this kind of healing cannot become an occupation. That is what can be said about it. The magnetic healing process is only effective, if we have the ability at all, if it is practiced with truly genuine and honest empathy with the patient, which goes right down into our own organism. If you practice magnetic healing out of true love for the patient, you cannot do it as an occupation. If true love is present, then it will lead to something positive under all circumstances, unless damage occurs from somewhere else. But in such an event, it can only be practiced occasionally. When driven by karma, we encounter a person whom we can help in a loving way. Then the outward sign can be the laying on of hands or stroking, and what acts is that the astral body transfers its power to the etheric body, which acts on the etheric body of the other person. We should also explain from a different perspective what happens in such a case. Healing always comes from the astral body, either our own astral body or, ultimately, the astral body of the practitioner of magnetic healing. The reverse process underlies treatment with medicines. When you treat someone with medicines, you are not doing anything other than putting substances into the physical body, which then act in such a way, partly corresponding to inner forces, partly to the rhythm of the physical body, that the etheric body of the patient is influenced. Healing always comes from the etheric body. On the one hand, you influence the etheric body from the astral body, that is, psychic healing, which includes magnetic healing. The latter, however, has something problematical, or only something that I might call humanitarian, something social, something that includes the relationship between one person and another. Or, alternatively, you have rational therapy, which is based on medicinal intervention. It moves from the physical body down into the etheric body. But healing always has to come from the etheric body. It is complete wishful thinking that the physical body, if it becomes ill, can bring about any sort of healing. The physical body has the causes of illness within itself. The causes of healing must always come from the etheric body. Question. What is the relationship between the heart and the female uterus and its position and soul experiences, pain and joy. There are directly associated experiences. First, the heart and uterus are two associated organs, even if they are not in direct contact, belonging together like the sun and the moon. Sun and moon are associated in such a way that they both throw the same light on something. In the one instance, the sun throws light directly on something, in the other by way of the moon, from whence it is reflected. The organ of the heart has immediate, direct impulses for the human organism. It is the organ of perception for the blood circulation, which takes place in the normal human organism. The female uterus is designed to be the organ of perception of the circulation which arises after fertilization. That is what it is there for. Just like the moon reflects the sunlight, so the female uterus reflects the perception of the heart in the blood circulation. It reflects it back. They always belong together like the sun and moon, in that their perceptions behave like direct and reflected effects. When human beings are here, they need heart forces. When they are being created, they need reflected heart forces. These come from the female uterus. Now, these organs, heart and uterus, together with some others, the lung takes it more toward the etheric and physical body, are nothing other than the physical manifestation of the soul element in human beings when looked at from a spiritual perspective. Let me put it like this. Think that you develop imaginative perception. If, in looking at a human being, you develop imaginative knowledge, you really do get an image of sun and moon when you look at heart and uterus. That is indeed the corresponding spiritual element which a person experiences in their soul, so that there is a real correspondence between the things which happen in the heart and the uterus. They do, however, happen in the semi-consciousness of the soul element, because normally the latter is influenced by thoughts. Thus a delicate process is hidden, the intimate connection between the heart and the uterus. But anyone who has a modicum of observation can see how much depends on that, how half unconsciously, or rather half consciously, the heart activity must develop under the influence of the physical environment. Someone who lives their life in such a way that they constantly experience a shock, through their work maybe, has a precise subconscious likeness in their soul of the heart activity that arises as a result, and that is reflected in the uterus. We can see how that happens, how it is transferred to the constitution of the embryo. Now we have a question which is difficult to answer, because it must either be answered superficially, that is, simply by providing some information, or we have to deal with it thoroughly. Question. How does wearing pearls and precious stones affect the individual organs? It does have an effect, but it works in such a way that we can really only judge its action if we look into the spiritual worlds, and we can only judge its action individually. We can easily say, for example, that sapphire acts on a particular temperament, on a choleric, but really only in individual cases. There are effects, but if we wanted to answer the question fully, we would have to deal with deeper things, which is not possible today. I can only answer this question. How can we gain insight into karma with regard to individual illnesses on the basis of what I said in the session? Some things will have become clear from what I said. Some things will still emerge from what I still have to say. Now, we have a number of questions here, and we also have the general questions, which can be answered with the esoteric remarks I made. But now we have here a question. Are there valid parallel relationships between the degree and length of post-mortem decomposition processes and the destiny of the associated individual in the spiritual world? There are really no relationships of any importance which would concern us human beings. It is, however, the case that the decomposition process is not just the physical process which it is normally considered to be in chemistry. something deeply spiritual is indeed linked with it. People had a feeling for that in the old instinctive knowledge. We say that the innermost core of a matter is its essence, and in decomposition we have a movement toward the essence. Translators note, the German term used here by Steiner for decomposition is verwesen, which is made up of the elements ver and wesen. Wesen in German means essence or being. Steiner here points out that the prefix ver, V-E-R, indicates movement toward something. So in verwesen, that would be movement toward the essence. End of translator's note. Humans are not closed-off beings. Spiritual beings are at work in them. We have certain beings in the physical, etheric, and astral body. We are only free in the I organization. Capital. These beings associated with the physical, etheric, and astral body are associated with what happens with the physical body after death. The question of decomposition or cremation is intimately connected with this. But all these things are intimately connected with human karma. We can only say that for the human being as such, for the individual human being, the question is not necessarily of any great significance. Question. Is there a certain period after death, following which a post-mortem examination influences the destiny of the deceased? It is completely without influence on the destiny of the deceased. Most of the questions have been answered in the general lectures. Oh yes, there is still one question which is of a certain importance. Question. My question is, are the healing abilities of physicians purely personal in nature, or are they dependent on a communal situation? Not a communal situation between the physician and patient, that is, but between communities of physicians. Is it possible that powers flow to the individual physician through such communities, which perhaps one might not be able to have at all by oneself, as is also the case in the community of priests? This is indeed the case, only it is the case in every human community. It is the case in every human community that powers flow to the human being from out of the community. But the community has to be a real community. It has to be felt, perceived, experienced. And what I have described to you and will describe even more clearly tomorrow is of such a nature that it can form a community among you together with us here, even if it initially can only be a community by correspondence. It should unite you in such a way that when you are alone, you will feel that powers will flow to you through such community, not just by intellectual, but also by spiritual means. A small group focused on this question. Training a physician's eye, EYE, are iris diagnosis, graphology, palmistry of value? Well, in an ideal situation, someone who can observe these connections could see an extraordinary amount about the overall state of a person from a small piece of fingernail you cut off, for example. That is quite possible. Just as you can see an exceptional amount from a human hair. You only have to consider how individual, how different a hair, for example, can be with regard to a person. You only have to consider how broadly, I might say, people are differentiated with regard to their hair. There are blonde people among you and people with black hair. Where does that come from? In those people with black hair, the blackness comes from an iron process which takes place in the hair. Those who are blonde have their blondness from a sulfur process which takes place in the hair, a sulfur process which is particularly strong in people with red hair. And we should note that these things are exceptionally interesting. I did indeed become acquainted with people where one could say that it meant something that they were fiery with their flaming red hair. There was an exceptionally strong real sulfur process, whereas black hair has a relatively strong iron process in it. Now, consider that this is the product of the whole human organization. In the one instance, we have a human being who constantly produces something that is an intensive combustible material, sulfur, so that it penetrates into his hair. In the other instance, he secretes something which is iron, which does not burn at all, but is something different. That shows a fundamental difference between the two people with regard to their organization. So something that is roughly the case in general is also the case specifically in each person with regard to their hair, so that you can recognize the whole human being from the composition of their hair. How, then, would it be possible not to understand human beings from the structure of their iris? But now you have to consider that these things require the highest level of knowledge, not the ridiculous knowledge which diagnosticians possess about the iris. That, of course, is crude. Particularly in these things that are based on real foundations, the path only leads to true knowledge when we reach the end of it. Just as in astrology, the path only leads to spirit knowledge at the end, whereas before that it is terribly amateurish. The same applies to palmistry and graphology. Graphology requires real inspiration. The way people write is a very individual thing. At best, we can give some guidance about it, but that guidance will be very rough. Here, too, the same applies, as I said before. It does truly require inspiration in order to draw conclusions about a person from graphology. Now, the peculiar thing about graphology is that the handwriting of a person in the present tells us about their state 7 years previously. That is an additional factor, so that the person who wants to draw conclusions about the present state of a person has to take a detour, has to pass through the whole development again. He arrives at the inner state 7 years ago, can then, if he has the vision, follow the path with what he perceived 7 years ago, and thus has a more thorough knowledge than he would otherwise have. A similar thing, as with the hair and iris, applies to what is observed by palmistry. But here, too, you have to have inspiration, not the superficial rules which are normally given. Palmistry, in turn, requires a very special facility, which maybe one or two people possess, in order to investigate the lines of the hands. The latter are indeed intimately connected with human development. All you need to do is compare the lines on your own hands with the lines of the left and the right hand. All you need to do is compare the lines on your own hands, what the lines of the left and the right hand look like. You see, in general life, it is so that people write with their right hand and not with their left. A difference exists. With regard to the lines of the hand, this difference is that we can see a person's whole karma in his left hand, if we are so inspired. In the right hand, we see the personal capability which that person has obtained in this life. His destiny created this earth life, and his capability leads him into the future. There is more to all these things than people think, but it is exceptionally dangerous to speak about them in public because we enter territory in which seriousness and charlatanism exist in close proximity. Our reflections here will naturally still lead on to a number of other things. You see, my dear friends, what I said yesterday at the end of the session means that being a physician involves truly profound moral soul states simply on the basis of the nature of the world's processes. Because I showed you that true knowledge about a medicine means that it will not work on the person who has that knowledge, that specifically the knowledge about a medicine contains something which means that the person with such knowledge excludes himself or herself from being healed by it. Now, the mere chemical knowledge does not, of course, exclude anything, because it is not knowledge. But true knowledge does exclude in that way. Consider the following. The human muscular system is grasped by imagination, cognitively grasped by imagination, as I showed yesterday. We learn to understand what is at work in the muscles by moving to pictorial imaginative cognition. But If we want to know what has a healing effect in a muscular organ, the therapeutic knowledge also has to be imaginative. True knowledge of an internal organ is obtained through inspiration. That is the only form of true knowledge. Chemical knowledge isn't. But let us now assume that you know that a medicine acts on the human muscular system in some way. You have that knowledge by imaginative means. But imaginative knowledge is not like knowledge as we think of it today, because the knowledge we think of today does not penetrate very deeply into a person. It really only exists in the head, whereas all imaginative knowledge simultaneously involves the human muscular system. Therapeutic imaginative knowledge is such, my dear friends, that you feel such knowledge in your muscles. You simply have to take these things properly, seriously. In order to make myself perfectly understood, I would like to go as far as to say something paradoxical about the matter. But this paradoxical thing is the truth. Title, My Philosophy of Freedom, has been little understood because people do not understand how to read it. They read it like any other book, but My Philosophy of Freedom is not meant like other books. My philosophy of freedom begins by living in the thoughts, but in really experienced thoughts. Thoughts which are not experienced, abstract, logical thoughts, which are generally prevalent in science today, are experienced in the brain. Such thoughts as I expressed in My Philosophy of Freedom, now we get to the paradoxical part, are experienced by the whole being in the skeletal system, properly as a whole human being in the skeletal system. And I want to say something even more paradoxical, something that has happened, of course, only you took no notice of it because you did not connect the two things. If people have understood My Philosophy of Freedom, they have dreamt several times of skeletons while they were reading it, and particularly after they were finished. That is connected morally with the whole position of the philosophy of freedom with regard to freedom in the world. Freedom already exists when we set the human muscles in motion in the world using the bones. The unfree person follows his drives and instincts. The free person is guided by the demands and requirements of the world which he must first love. He must establish a relationship with this world. That comes to expression in the imagination of the skeletal system. Inwardly, it is the skeletal system which experiences the thoughts we experience. So, experienced thoughts are experienced in the skeletal system with the whole human being, namely with the whole solidly physical human being. There have been people who wanted to paint pictures from my book. They showed me all kinds of things. They wanted to present the thoughts in the philosophy of freedom in pictorial form. If we want to paint the content of these thoughts by such means, we have to present dramatic scenes that are carried out by human skeletons. Just as freedom itself is something in connection with which we have to jettison everything of a purely instinctive nature, so, what people experience when they have thoughts of freedom is something for which they have to jettison their flesh and blood. They have to become skeleton, earth-like. Their thoughts truly have to become earth-like. That does not mean that we have to work our own way out of it. I mention this so that you can see that even in ordinary thoughts, something happens in which the whole human being is taken hold of. If we move from the thought to imagination, we experience our imagination in the muscular system. We experience inspiration inwardly in our own organs. Only in the case of inspiration we should never forget the saying, Naturalia non sunt turpia, because it can happen that the most wonderful inspirations are experienced with the kidneys or other lower organs. Readers aside, Latin translation is, what is natural is not shameful. Apparently it was a saying by the cynics. End of readers aside. So higher knowledge really does make demands on the whole human being. And anyone who does not know that imagining is work that is very similar to physical work, because it strains the muscles like real physical work, can have no idea of imagination and inspiration. Hence, there is also a correlation between physical work and imagination. If I may mention something personal, for example, I have always found that it made a huge contribution to my imagining that I chopped wood as a boy, lifted potatoes, worked with a spade, sewed, and did similar things. Well, I do not want to boast about these things, but having done them makes it easier to work the muscles hard to facilitate imagining. Just like being used to any particular thing makes that thing easier. That is how it is if you have exercised muscles in your youth, and if you want to imagine later on. But you see, movements that are not work are of no use. Playing as such is of no benefit for imagining. I do not want to say anything against play. You only need to look at my educational things to see that I have nothing against play. But imagining creates a similar experience in the resting muscle, because it has to be done at rest, of course, as real physical work. So you can see, as you learn about these admittedly curious things in context here with us, on your way to being a physician, how knowledge of these therapeutic things intervenes in your muscular system, and that is something that will be of importance in your karma. Let us assume, for example, that you have become familiar with, I am constructing a purely hypothetical case, let us say the real treatment for smallpox. Real smallpox provokes a very strong inspiration, even including intuition. And what you truly know by this means, my dear friends, if you are real therapists in this field, has a much stronger effect on you if it is true knowledge than vaccination. It has a much stronger effect in a different sense. And in studying the treatment of smallpox, as a physician, you will cause a kind of preventive healing in yourself, and in that way will prepare yourself, if you understand the connection, to be among smallpox sufferers without fear, in complete love. But all these things, in turn, have their reverse side. Because, you see, what you acquire as knowledge of a medicine is, if it is truly imaginative or inspired knowledge, a real medicine, it has healing forces within it. It does not even need to be your own imagination, but only one which someone else has, and that is something everyone can do, as I keep repeating. Having the idea of a medicine is effective, but it is only effective for as long as you are fearless, because fear is the opposite pole from love. If you go into a sick room with fear, all your therapy will be of no help. If you enter it with love, you can disregard yourself. Indeed, you can focus with all your soul on those whom you have to heal, can live in love in your imaginative inspired knowledge. Then, you see, you will not be involved in the healing process out of a personal quality, as this fearful person with knowledge, but as a loving person with knowledge. Thus medicine is driven toward morality, not just from outside, but also from inside. And thus something applies to a high degree in the field of medicine, which applies in all fields where we are dealing with spiritual knowledge. We have to develop courage. As you know, courage is what surrounds us everywhere. The air is illusion. Courage is what surrounds us everywhere. If we want to live in the world in which we breathe, we need to develop courage. If we are cowardly in some way, we do not live in the world. We exclude ourselves. We only appear to breathe. The thing you need above all else to study medicine is courage, the courage to heal. It truly is the case that if you have the courage to heal an illness, that in itself is the right outlook, which in 90% of the cases will lead to the correct result, because it is so that these moral qualities are most intimately connected with the process of healing. That is why it should be as follows. First course for medical students. Those things which I set out in the first three sessions. Creating a basis through obtaining a greater or lesser knowledge of nature and human beings, of the cosmos and human beings. Then the second course, esoteric deepening regarding the action of medical powers, looking at medicine in the way I did in the fourth session, and in what I will discuss tomorrow. Then there has to be a final course, which must essentially aim to look at treatment in the context of the development of the proper moral abilities by physicians, because the one thing must support the other. And if the final medical course contains what is morally qualified in this way, then disease will truly become the opposite for the physician to what it is for the patient. It becomes something which the physician loves, not in the sense of nurturing it so that the patient remains ill for as long as possible, but which he loves because the disease only acquires its meaning when it is healed. What does that mean? You see, my dear friends, being healthy means bearing the spiritual qualities, the so-called normal soul and spiritual qualities within one. But being ill, having some kind of illness, means actually being influenced by a spiritual quality. I know, of course, that if one of the clever people of our time hears what I am saying now, he will say, "Aha, here comes the old teaching of possession." Well, it is arguable whether the old teaching of possession is worse than the new one, whether one is possessed by spirits or germs. That is something the value of which still needs to be investigated. Modern physicians always declare themselves in favor of possession in their medical teaching, only it is more appropriate for their understanding to teach about materialistic possession. But it is the case that when we have an illness, we have a spiritual quality in us which is not present in the normal course of a person's life, but it is a spiritual quality. There is another paradox I must mention. Let us assume that you want to understand the connection, I am speaking about a very real fact here, between the elements of the zodiac. Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces. Now there is a colossal difference between these seven constellations, and there's a picture on the top, and these five constellations on the bottom of the picture. If you rise up to imagination, you get a being that appears to be male for these seven constellations, and a being that appears to be female for these five constellations. So that in actual fact, male-female spreads out over the zodiac in a closed serpentine form in the imaginative perception. Well, no one can receive this imagination without going through the following. Imagine smallpox, which reveals itself in the symptoms of the physical body. But imagine if the following were possible. Imagine a person suffering from smallpox, who would have the strength in his astral body and eye organization to draw out the whole of the smallpox disease and only experience it in the astral body and eye, so that at that moment his physical body was cured. Assume that this was hypothetically possible. What I have set out here cannot happen, but if you want to have this imagination, you must, without your physical and etheric body taking it on, go through the same thing as I set out hypothetically with regard to smallpox. You have to suffer smallpox in your astral body and eye organization, free of the physical and etheric body. In other words, you have to spiritually experience a spiritual correlate of physical illness. Smallpox, my dear friends, is the physical reflection of the state of the eye organization and astral body when you have such an imagination. Now, you will understand that in smallpox, the influence is simply at work in human beings themselves, which, with spiritual insight, becomes the heavenly imagination. Here you can see how closely being ill is related to the spiritual life and not to the physical body. Illness is the physical imagination of the spiritual life. And because the physical imagination should not be there, because it should not imitate certain spiritual processes, something can be a disease in the physical organization which in the spiritual world might be of the highest order. We therefore have to understand illness in such a way that we say, if it were not possible through certain things, which we will examine tomorrow, to fetch down certain spiritual beings to where they do not belong, they would not be present in the spiritual world either. That shows how closely real spiritual knowledge and illness are related. We actually already recognize the illness when we recognize the spirit. We cannot do anything else. Once we have such a heavenly imagination, we know what the disease of smallpox is, because it is only the physical projection of our spiritual experience. That basically applies to all our knowledge about illness. We might say that when heaven, or hell, of course, takes too strong a hold of a person, he becomes ill. If they only take hold of his soul and spirit, he becomes wise, or clever, or insightful. These are things which you, my dear friends, will have to digest in your soul. Then you will understand the task of anthroposophy as it relates to being a physician, because anthroposophy reveals the correct divine archetypes of what is demonically reflected in the diseases. But that can lead you deeper and deeper into the knowledge that the reform of medical studies, which is necessary today, must be sought on the ground of anthroposophy. The end of Lecture 7.